Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to The Conservative Cauldron, Bewitching Radio.
And the greatest armada in military history is assembled in England for an assault on Hitler's fortress Europe, all under the supreme command of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who has British General Montgomery at his side. British and U.S. planes bomb the French coast around the clock, dropping 9,000 tons of explosives during a few hours before the landing. The Allies have complete control of the air and cover the surface forces as Allied troops pile into landing craft. 500 warships lay down a withering barrage, and it's the beginning of the end for Hitler's dreams of world conquest. Casualties were heavy in those early hours, but the Allies were on their way to Berlin.
Good Friday evening, conservative cauldron people, and every other people of the Americas. It is Friday night, finally, and where else would you be on Friday night but right here listening to Conservative Cauldron Radio? I'm Becky Noble. Thank you so much for hanging out and chilling with me tonight. Again, like I said, we have made it to the end. We have made it through the tunnel, my people, to the end, to the other side. And the weekend is here. We will rejoice. I know I will. And, of course, we are... Well, we're rejoicing because it's the weekend, but we're also, not only are we rejoicing, but we are, we're commemorating. We are commemorating, of course, today. Today is the 70th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, the Allied invasion in World War II. And it's always a somber day. It's a day of remembrance. It's a day of giving thanks, actually. It's a day of giving thanks to these brave men who risked it all, who jumped out of airplanes. They were kids. They were 19, 20 years old, and they changed world history, an entire generation of them. They landed on beaches in foreign countries, far away from home and family and friends and loved ones, and they did what needed to be done. They did what they had to do to defend America and defend our ideals and our honor and our way of life and our values, and they defended our nation from evil like Adolf Hitler and Mussolini and all of the evil ideas that come to mind when one hears those names. And President Obama was over in Normandy today at the commemoration ceremony. And, you know, here's the thing about these guys is that, again, like I said, these were guys who were just kids who were 19, 20 years old, and in a lot of ways, the aftermath of 9/11 parallels this, because I know I have in my own experience, and I know many other people have too, that right after 9/11, that they talked to so many people, and there were so many, in this day and age, so many young men and women who after 9/11, who were so affected by it and felt so deeply and so strongly about it, that they joined up, that they signed up to go and fight, and they signed up to go and defend our nation. And that's pretty much what went on here. You know, after Pearl Harbor, so many young men were inspired to go and defend our nation. And the majority of a lot of these guys, this is where they ended up on June the 6th, 1944. And like I said, it's not only is it a day of commemoration, but it's really kind of also a day to give thanks to that generation, the greatest generation. And the thing with these guys, and you know, while we're sitting here today talking about the 70th anniversary of D-Day, and we've been, it seems like for the past how many weeks now, we have been, that all things military have been front and center in our minds, whether or not you're talking about the VA scandal, whether or not you're talking about Bo Bergdahl, and of course we're going to get to him in a minute, but so many of these guys, like I said, we can all do the math here. This is the 70th anniversary of this invasion. And the guys who were just kids then, who were 19, 20, 21, 22 years old, they're old men now. They're grandfathers, they're great-grandfathers, and we're losing them. We're losing that generation at a rapid pace. And I hope that my hope for people, my grandfathers did not serve in World War II, but I would hope that people who have World War II vets still remaining and still with them and their families, be they a father or a grandfather or an uncle or a brother, whoever it is, try to document their stories. Try to document the things that they tell you and the things that they saw and the things that they heard and the things that went on around them when they were these young men fighting for their country. And, you know, I would hope that somebody would just... Everybody's got a recorder now on your phone. You got a camera on your phone now. Record these guys. Record the things that they say. Record the stories that they tell you. Because I believe the stat on this now is that there are about 900 to 1,000 World War II veterans dying every day. And so it's going to be up to us. It's going to be up to the next generation to keep their stories alive, not just to keep their memories alive, keep their stories alive and keep alive the history that they saw with their own eyes. And so I think probably the best thing for us to do here today is to commemorate this amazing and incredible moment in history, and commemorate the amazing thing that these guys did when they were, like I said, just so young and so, no doubt, incredibly terrified and pretty. Probably were all fairly confident that they were going to die that day, that they were not going to come home, that they were not ever going to see their friends and family and loved ones ever again. But, and yeah, we did lose a lot of them that day. I think we lost about 2,500 of them that day. And they gave the ultimate sacrifice. But for the guys who made it through and for the guys who did come home, thank you. Thank you for changing the world, and thank you for making history, and thank you for defending our nation and defending our country, defending who America is. And I wanted to start out with that tonight because it is a big deal, and there's so many things like D-Day that are getting lost to time, and it seems as though I'm probably going to sound like an old fart here, but It seems like that the younger generation, that younger people, I don't know if it's just the fact that maybe history is not being taught anywhere near the way it should be anymore in public schools. I don't know about private schools. Hopefully it's a little better there. But it's either the fact that history is not being taught, or that it just, you know, everybody can remember when they were a teenager in junior high and high school, when you're sitting in school and, you know, you were listening to names of battles and dates, and, you know, it went in one ear and out the other. It was just, it seemed as though it was just a rattling off of names and dates. And I guess as you get older, you realize that it's not just names and dates, but it's the history of your nation. And it's, what's that old saying? If you don't know where you've come from, you don't know where you're going. You know, I guess you don't realize that until you get older. And it seems as though things like D-Day, the celebration of, not celebration, maybe that's a bad choice of words, but the commemoration of D-Day and things like it are just not important to younger people and to younger generations. And that's what we need to change. And the only way that we can change that is, again, like I said, is, you know, keeping the memories of our World War II veterans alive and keeping their stories alive so that generations who are here after they're all gone can hear those stories. And so again, to all of our remaining World War II veterans, thank you. Thank you for your service, and thank you for your defense of our nation. But again, I wanted to start off with that tonight because I thought that it was more appropriate to start off with true heroes than it would be to start off talking about what it seems as though the entire country, maybe even the whole world, has been talking about for the past week, and that would be the ongoing saga of Bo Bergdahl and his family. Wow, you know, where do we start with this? It's a story that is literally changing almost minute by minute. It seems as though every half an hour, you know, there's new reports coming forth. There's new things being reported. And, you know, I think that, of course, there's going to be a lot of things that that we really, truly will not know until Sergeant Bergdahl is home on American soil, and he has gone through the appropriate physical, medical, psychological reviews and checkups and things of that nature that he is going through right now at I believe it's at Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany. And gosh, there are so many questions surrounding this. What by all accounts, and I think everyone has seen clips of an amazing interview that Fox News's Megyn Kelly has done with about six members of Bo Bergdahl's unit, and these were guys who were there in Afghanistan on the ground, and know what they saw, and what they saw was a fellow soldier who deserted them, basically. They were asked point blank, did any of them have any, was there any doubt in their minds that Bo Bergdahl deserted his unit and deserted his post? Every single one of them said yes. Anyone who is been in the military, and whether regardless of what branch it is, anyone who is a veteran who has been in the military or who is now active in the military knows what a grievous, and that doesn't even begin to cover it, what a grievous, serious offense this is. And by all accounts, it seems that maybe Sergeant Bergdahl was disillusioned with the American presence in Afghanistan, that maybe he was not entirely sure why we were there and what we were doing or what we were supposed to be doing. As of today, various news outlets are, I believe this is probably, that this may be an effort to start portraying him as just a very confused individual that really doesn't know why he is where he is and why he's doing what he's doing, and just that he's very bewildered and very, very confused about who and where he is. And hopefully there are not a lot of people who are going to buy that. And there are just, you know, like I said, it's a story that you just kind of look at and go, where do we begin? Of course, there are many, many questions surrounding President Obama's decision on this. There are several accounts that say some pretty high up brass in the military advised against this, but you know, we have seen time and time again, and I think we've got two more years to see it. Barack Obama's blatant disregard, well, obviously, he has disregard for Congress, because Congress was not notified of the decision to make this deal with the Taliban and hand over these prisoners. But you know, let's start out. I guess the best place to start out here is at the beginning. This was last Sunday in the Rose Garden at the White House, and President Obama was there with Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's parents.
I just want to say thank you to everyone who has supported Bo. He's had a wonderful team everywhere. We will continue to stay strong for Bo while he recovers. Thank you.
I'd like to say to Bo right now, who's having trouble speaking English, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Zayabayim. I'm your father, Bo. The people of Afghanistan, the same. Khalifa al-Thani, the complicated nature of this recovery will never really be comprehended. To each and every single one who affected this in this country, in the service branches, at the State Department, throughout the whole of American government.
You know, there can be a lot of things said about parents who have endured their son being held in captivity for 5 years. So in all fairness, let's kind of start there. I don't think that anybody really knows, maybe no one really knows how or what they would, how they would react or what are the things that they might do were they in that situation. And God forbid that no set of parents, you know, that doesn't have to be is in this situation that the Bergdahls were. So in all fairness, maybe we need to keep that front and center, that this is a set of parents, first of all, who are terrified at the thought of their son being held captive. But if you go on from there, for anybody who saw this press conference and saw the Bergdahls in, you know, at the podium with the president, maybe not so much his mother, but Bo Bergdahl's father is he's a pretty curious looking individual. He has what I have heard been called a Taliban beard, a terrorist beard. There have been plenty of descriptions for Robert Bergdahl, Sergeant Bergdahl's father. The original story behind his Duck Dynasty kind of beard is that it was in response that he was going to grow his beard until his son was returned home. Okay, maybe that's true. My biggest question, and I can't believe that I was the only person to think this, the biggest question that stared at me right in the face from the minute I watched, the first time I watched this press conference, was why is this father so fluent in Pashtun, which is the language of the Taliban? And you know, I don't know very many people that are. And I've heard theories about this father and about this set of parents who want to understand their son's captor. It might sound like a lot of liberal gobbledygook. again, it maybe it's a situation that everyone reacts to differently. I don't know that if I were someone whose son was being held captive by the kind of people that he was being held captive, I don't know that my first response to that would be to learn their language. I don't know that there would be a whole lot of people whose first response would be to learn their language. Some of the guys who were traded for Sergeant Bergdahl, there were five pretty high level Taliban commanders who were traded for Bo Bergdahl's release. The Weekly Standard here had a fantastic bio on the Gitmo Five, as they've been called. But they are Mullah Mohammad Fazi. He is the Taliban Army Chief of Staff. We have Mullah Nurullah Nori. He is a senior Taliban military commander. Abdul Haq Wazik, Taliban Deputy Minister of Intelligence. Karula Kirkawa, I'm sure I'm butchering these names, Taliban Governor of the Herat Province and former Interior Minister. And last but not least, Mohammed Nabi. He is a senior Taliban figure and security official. So these guys are not your average run-of-the-mill, Joe Blow, Mohammed Blow, Taliban street fighters. These are high-level guys. These are guys that the Taliban asked for specifically. They are, they've been called the Taliban Dream Team, if you will. Mullah Mohammad Fazi Fazi is wanted by the UN for possible war crimes, including the murder of thousands of Shiite Muslims. Mullah Nurullah Nori, he is also wanted by the UN. So we have two guys here who are wanted by the United Nations for war crimes that include the murder of thousands of Shiite Muslims. Nori, beginning in the mid-1990s, fought alongside al-Qaeda as a Taliban military general. He's continued to work closely with al-Qaeda. Abdul Haq Wazik. He arranged for al-Qaeda members to provide crucial intelligence training prior to 9/11. So here's a guy who was quite possibly involved indirectly on the fringes of the 9/11 attacks here that murdered 3,000 Americans in one morning, because, well, let's call it what it is. 3,000 Americans were murdered in one morning. And this guy right here may have had something to do with it indirectly, but we're giving him his walking papers. We have the guy with two names here, Karula Kirkawa. Say that three times fast. He was the governor of Afghanistan's westernmost province prior to 9/11. In that capacity, he executed sensitive missions for Mullah Omar, who was a 9/11 collaborator, including helping to broker a secret deal with the Iranians. So there's that. So he's got that going for him. And Mohammed Nabi, a senior Taliban official who served in multiple leadership roles. Nabi had strong operational ties to anti-coalition militia groups, including al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the Haqqani network. And the Haqqanis are the main crowd who were holding Sergeant Bergdahl hostage. And he has remained, they've all remained quite active, prior to their stay at Club Gitmo. And, here's the thing. I've heard so many liberals on TV bat around the notion that, these guys have been in captivity for 12, 13 years now. They're old. Their terrorist heyday is behind them, and they're just a bunch of old guys cooling their heels at Gitmo. Well, actually, nothing could be further from the truth, because there are some credible reports here from credible senior U.S. military individuals and other journalists who have done some great reporting. James Rosen at Fox News is one of them who has done some over-the-top fantastic reporting this week on this story that, oh no, that what they've been doing at Gitmo, these guys have been resting up until they return to the battlefield in Afghanistan with their fellow Al-Qaeda members. They're just, like I said, they're just cooling their jets. They're just cooling their heels until somebody gives them their walking papers and says, hey, Mohammed, time for you to fly. And so that's what they're doing. And here's the thing. When you release five of the most senior Taliban military commanders there are, and again, these are guys who have been described as the Taliban dream team. These are guys who the Taliban specifically requested. They didn't just say, hey, hand over some of our guys. They said, we want this guy, this guy, this guy, and this guy. And oh yeah, while you're at it, throw in that guy too. They were specifically asked for. And, you know, one of the big questions that remain now today, there's so many, one of the biggest ones that remains here is that, you know, what is the going price for an American life right now overseas? Is it 5 terrorists? A month from now, will it be 10? We've got to ask, what's the going rate for an American life now? Because now what we've done here is we've set a precedent. We've set a precedent for bad actors all around the world that if you want to get some of your guys back, pick a terrorist organization, be it Al-Qaeda. Maybe next time it could be Hamas. It could be, you know, any one of a dozen of those groups that operate in that area of the world. Those guys are looking at this deal right now and saying, okay, well, how many of our guys can we get back? How many Americans do we need to capture in order to get five of our guys back, 10 of our guys back, whatever it is, or how many do we need to capture in order to get this one specific guy or these two or three specific guys just like this? How do we get them back? How many Americans do we need to kidnap? And it not only sets a precedent for Americans in the military overseas, but why stop there? What's to stop these guys from kidnapping diplomats? Anyone who is an American who maybe lives and works overseas for whatever reason, and maybe they're not a diplomat or maybe they're not in the military. We're treading on dangerous ground here. And when this whole swap took place, and from what I have read in getting ready for the show tonight, that this is not something that just took place overnight. It's not something that just came about in the course of, you know, a few weeks' time. They've been working on this. And one of the other biggest controversies about all of this is the president's just complete and total sidestepping of Congress. Congressmen and women who are on the Armed Services Committee, Senator Dianne Feinstein is a Democrat, a very liberal Democrat, and she has a big problem with this whole thing. And so it's not just Republicans who are getting up on top of desktops and yelling and screaming. There's Democrats that are doing it too. And my guess is that a lot of the Democrats that are doing it are the Democrats who are in very vulnerable positions come November when the midterm elections happen. Because they're already going to have it tough because of Obamacare. And now this is happening. And this story is just at the beginning. It's only a week old. And it's gonna blossom as soon as Bo Bergdahl is home on American soil. And but why did the president feel the need to sidestep Congress and not let them know? I can't remember the name of the procedure, but there before things like this happens, there's supposed to be a 30-day notification of Congress that, in fact, this prisoner swap is going to take place. And none of that happened in this case. And the Obama administration has come forward and said that, well, the reason for this is that we had grave concerns about Sergeant Bergdahl's health. Well, for anyone who saw the video of the prisoner swap, he looked like he was getting around pretty well. He was moving on his own power. You know, maybe there are health concerns here that are not, you know, visual to the naked eye. Maybe it's something internal. We don't know at this point. There's so many questions surrounding this. And I'm going to take a break here, but when I get back, we're going to talk about one of the latest reports. Again, like I said, by Fox News's James Rosen, again, who has done some fantastic reporting on this story. There have been reports that Sergeant Bergdahl converted to Islam and was calling himself a warrior for Islam. We're going to talk about that plus a whole lot more, and I got a really cool story about an elderly British paratrooper who, well, he kind of did it all over again. It was really cool, and all I got to say to that is, you go, Grandpa, but I'm going to take a break. We will be right back. It is Friday, people. Time to party.
And we're back.
You're listening to Conservative Cauldron Radio. I'm Becky Noble, your host. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining me tonight. It is finally Friday. My people, can you believe it? I know it was iffy there for a while. Long about Wednesday or so, you start sweating and you start thinking, oh my God, am I going to make it? I just don't know. You know, we've all been there. But here we are at the on the other side, out of the tunnel. That is the week. That is the work week. And here we are. It's Friday night. Everybody, relax. Chill out. The weekend is here. But we are talking about, well, you know, today is the 70th anniversary of D-Day. And so we want to commemorate that and take time out to reflect on the amazing feat of history that those brave men carried out on that fateful day. And we thank them from the bottom of our hearts for their service and for their sacrifice in defense of our nation. And we know that so many of them, we're losing so many of them at a rapid pace. And so we want to thank them while they're still around for us to thank. And we want to keep their memories and their stories alive. And I hope that everyone who has a World War II veteran in their family will do just that. But, of course, we're also talking about the prisoner swap this week. The Taliban Dream Team in exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who, by all accounts, deserted his unit, deserted his post, and left his fellow soldiers kind of flapping in the breeze. And from what I have seen, again, I was talking on the other before the break, that for anybody who has seen it, Megyn Kelly on the Fox News Channel has done an amazing interview with about six guys who were in Bo Bergdahl's unit, and they don't hold back. They are able now to talk about it. They were asked at the time to sign non-disclosure agreements, not to talk about this. And, well, they're talking about it now. And what's funny is the fact that, well, not funny, haha, but funny, are you kidding me, funny? That now that they are able to talk about this, members of the Obama administration are questioning their credibility. They are questioning their honesty. They're even questioning their sanity. And that's what happens when liberals can't defend their actions. They have to throw you under the bus and call you names and, you know, question your veracity. And it's one thing if you do it to average Americans. At this point, we expect it from the Obama administration and anyone who is associated with them. But when you start to demean and question the credibility and question the character of our veterans, question the character of guys who willingly signed on the dotted line to defend this nation, and they went in and they did it. They did the job that they were asked to do, and they were the ones who did it with honor and distinction, not Bo Bergdahl, the way Susan Rice described it. One of the actually, in the midst of this horrific case, one of the funniest actually things that I heard was this evening from Fox News' Charles Krauthammer, who said that perhaps Susan Rice should stay in bed on Sunday mornings and stop going on Sunday shows. Which, well, yeah, she might want to consider that. Sleep in next week, Susan. Okay, just saying. There's a thought. It's something you might want to think of. But you know, for members of an administration to be questioning the credibility and questioning the honesty of men who put their lives on the line and went to a faraway place to defend our nation, and they did it with bravery and honor and valor, and they did it the way that it was supposed to be done. For people who have no idea, and I think somebody who has no military experience, such as myself or anybody else, it's so blatantly apparent that this administration, this president and this administration literally have no clue what the American military is about, what they stand for, what their ideals are, what their values are. They just have no clue about the United States military and who these people are who sign on the dotted line and go into harm's way, and they do it knowing that there's a good chance that they might not come back to their loved ones, but they do it anyway because they want to defend our nation. These people have no clue about these guys. They have no clue what they are about. And not only do they not have a clue, they really are not interested in getting one. And so that's one of the things that just, you can't wrap your brain around it. So that's how liberals in the Obama administration are responding to these guys that Megyn Kelly interviewed, guys who were there on the ground with Bo Bergdahl and saw what transpired that night and the night that he disappeared. And one of the most interesting, really fascinating theories that I have heard about this didn't come from anyone political. It was brought to my attention by someone who was listening to morning radio here in St. Louis on a country music station, and they were discussing this case, as is everybody. It just doesn't matter. You don't have to be a talk radio station to be talking about this week. But one of the theories floated about was that if anybody notices right now, all talk of the VA has stopped. All talk of the VA has ceased. And the theory that was floated was that the whole VA scandal is such a black eye for this administration and this president that it's so bad that they were looking for something. They were looking for something good, something positive. They were looking for a feel-good story about a soldier or a veteran. And when this story came to light, the entire administration, President Obama included, thought, here we go. Here's a story about a guy who has been in captivity. At one point he had escaped from his captors, was recaptured and kept in a cage meant for an animal. But we got him back. We had to trade a couple of terrorists. Never mind the fact that they're senior Al Qaeda terrorists. We'll deal with that later after they kill some more Americans. But we traded these guys for our soldier. We got our soldier back, and now he's going to come home. Isn't this great? There was a big party planned. Everybody was happy, and the whole story has backfired because it is not a feel-good story about a hero coming home, about someone who endured years of captivity and now is coming home to his family. It's in no way a story like that. And that was the theory that was floated about, was that perhaps this whole story came about because there was the need for a feel-good vet story in light of the whole hideous VA scandal and people being angry and wanting accountability. And ironically enough, and again, I have to cite this amazing interview that Megyn Kelly did with these six guys from Bo Bergdahl's unit, was that that was the one thing that they all expressed gratitude that he was coming home, because they, like most soldiers, they believe in not leaving anyone behind. You don't leave any of your men behind. When you say that phrase and you're talking about the Obama administration, I guess you have to have that little asterisk but next to the word Benghazi. But these are guys who truly believe in that concept of not leaving any man behind. So they were all glad that Sergeant Bergdahl is coming home to his family, but they want him to be held accountable. They want him to, even the word court-martial was also brought up. And if that's what needs to happen, the military says that they are going to fully investigate this. We'll see what happens here and see if they determine that a court-martial is is what's needed. But the one thing that all six of these guys stated was that the one thing that they all wanted was for Bo Bergdahl to be held accountable. They wanted him to be held accountable for his actions, for leaving his fellow soldiers behind. You don't do that. You don't do that. And, you know, again, there are so many questions surrounding this case, and we're just at the beginning. We're just getting started. I don't want to take up the entire hour talking about this. One of the other things that went on this week, although you'd never know it because of the story, was that on Monday, the Obama administration took aim at the coal industry by mandating a 30% cut in carbon emissions at fossil fuel burning power plants by 2030. Despite claims that all of these regulations will cost nearly a quarter million jobs a year and force plants across the country to close. The controversial regulations, which some lawmakers already are trying to block, is one of the most sweeping efforts to tackle global warming by this or any other administration. So, you know, in case anybody thinks that global warming has gone away, oh no, it's just right there. It's underneath all of the actually really more important things that we need to worry about, like a sitting president releasing Taliban high up Taliban leaders in order for them to go back to the battlefield to kill Americans. This is a 645-page plan expected to be finalized next year, and is a centerpiece of President Obama's climate change agenda. We have a moral obligation to act, said EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy in announcing the plan on Monday morning. Excuse me here for just a minute. While the proposed legislation drew praise from environmental groups, of course, and that's what's going on here, really. It's about keeping the left happy, and it's about keeping the left happy enough to vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016. I mean, let's call it what it is. The coal industry and coal state lawmakers were immediately wary. Democratic West Virginia Representative Nick Rahal announced he would introduce legislation along with Representative David McKinley, also of West Virginia, Republican, to stop the EPA plan. And again, here, where else have we heard this? Is that this whole 640-page? And again, why are all these bills? You know, I've heard lawmakers, you know, come on radio and TV and talk about how they want to create a rule that will only make these bills X number of pages long, so you know you don't have to go away for 2 months to read them. But this particular draft here about the coal fire plant regulations, again, sidesteps Congress. Gee, where have we heard that before? Oh, I don't know. Was it about prisoner swaps? That could be. What else was it about? Oh, various assorted amendments to Obamacare? Yes, that might be where we've heard it before, too. And it seems that we are hearing it more and more every day. Under the plan, carbon emissions would be reduced 30% by 2030 compared with 2005 levels. EPA data shows that the nation's power plants have reduced carbon dioxide emissions by nearly 13% since 2005. The EPA is expected to offer a range of options to states to meet targets that will be based on where they get their electricity and how much carbon dioxide they will emit in the process. If a state refuses to create a plan, the EPA can make its own. That's always a bad thing when the government comes in and says, well, if you're not going to come up with a plan of your own, we'll do that for you. Yeah, how do you think that's going to go? Ronald Reagan once say some of the scariest words in the English language were, "Hi, I'm from the federal government and I'm here to help"? Yeah, that's kind of what that is. The Obama administration claimed the changes would produce jobs, cut electricity bills, save thousands of lives thanks to cleaner air. I'm not sure how that works, given the fact that you're going to close all of these plants and you're going to lose up to what was the number here again? You're going to lose up to 250,000 jobs. You know, I was never good at math, but that seems like a little, seems like some reversal there to me. How are you going to create jobs, but you're going to cut them at the same time? I don't know. Is it? It could be liberal math. I don't know. It's. I know what it is. It's Common Core math. That's what it is. But in a quote here from Republican Party Chairman Reince Priebus, throughout his presidency, Barack Obama has adopted a my way or the highway approach, and that explains why he's shoving these EPA regulations down our throat. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has found that each year this regulation will kill 224,000 jobs and force energy rates to skyrocket. So it's no wonder President Obama is circumventing Congress to implement his latest job-killing regulation. Hundreds of coal-burning plants will have to comply, which has resulted in strong opposition from the energy industry. And again, congressmen and senators from coal-producing states like West Virginia and Kentucky, this is going to be a big deal because there are quite a few Democrats who represent people in those states. And they could find themselves again, once again, come November, they could find themselves pretty vulnerable here. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce argues that the rule will kill jobs and close power plants across the country. The group released a study that finds the rule will result in the loss of 224,000 jobs every year through 2030. So that's 224,000 jobs every year through 2030 and impose $50 billion in annual costs. So for those of you who like to complain about your utility bills and your electric bills, well, just wait a while because it's only going to get better. And it's probably all going to get better, you know, about the same time. Your energy bills and your medical bills, thanks to Obamacare, are all going to be at about the same level, basically. Without waiting to see what Obama proposes, governors in Kansas, Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia have already signed laws directing their environmental agencies to develop their own carbon emission plans. Similar measures recently passed in Missouri and are pending in the Louisiana and Ohio legislatures. So what's interesting here is Obama is being forced to use the 1970s-era Old Clean Air Act. The law has long been used to regulate pollutants like soot, mercury, and lead, but has only recently been applied to greenhouse gases. Law from the 70s has been kind of revitalized here to take on things like greenhouse gas emissions and things of that nature. And, you know, this is another thing that candidate Obama suggested that he would need to do that, well, anybody who remembers the quote about him saying, well, you know, you can build a power plant if you want to, but your costs are going to necessarily skyrocket. It's still kind of mind-boggling that someone would actually come out and someone who's a candidate at that point would come out and say, well, yeah, your utility bills are going to necessarily skyrocket, and here's why. But you know, there's even more reason for him to do that now. He's not going to face the voters ever again. And there are plenty of Democrats who are pretty vulnerable come November. The list may grow longer here with this list of regulations and the imminent looming of job loss in places that really can't afford to see much more job loss. You know, communities who are coal mining communities who are not wealthy communities. You know, a lot of these coal plants are closing, and in these areas there are not a lot of other economic opportunities for people. And you know, you have generations of people who have worked in coal mines, and you know, their job prospects are rapidly going away. And so that will be interesting to see how that goes over. There was also this week, here in St. Louis, for anybody who's not listening that's in the St. Louis area, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which is a little, it's a little left-leaning. It leans a little left. Did an editorial on how poverty is crushing African Americans in the St. Louis region. It was a study done by the George Warren Brown School of Social Work here at Washington University. And it was called For the Sake of All, a Report on the Health and Well-Being of African Americans in St. Louis. Well, of course, the left-leaning Post-Dispatch found, well, actually it was the study, but the Post-Dispatch was all too happy to report it, found that if you're black in St. Louis, you're more likely than if you're white to live in poverty, have less education, die earlier, have higher incidences of diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. And what this study tried to do, basically, it seemed to me as though it was being presented in more of a medical capacity, people who are suffering from these chronic illnesses. But at the end of this editorial, you know, we're talking about more money for early education. We're talking about helping low to moderate income families. Low to moderate income families create economic opportunity. And, you know, if you read this piece about this study, it seemed to me as though it was very thinly veiled social justice being suggested here. And some of the things here that the study and that the Post-Dispatch article does not talk about, are a few other statistics. And, right now here in the St. Louis region, the black unemployment rate is 11.6%. The out-of-wedlock birth rate is a staggering 87%. The high school graduation rate is 78.5%. But here's the rub. Here's the deal with all of this. And that is that the city of St. Louis, not surrounding St. Louis County, but the city of St. Louis has not had a Republican mayor since 1949. The city of St. Louis has not had a congressman represent them in Washington, not a Republican congressman, since 1949. Of the 28 Board of Aldermen in the city of St. Louis, 27 of them are Democrats, one independent. Of 11 state representatives who go to Jefferson City and represent the people of St. Louis there in the Missouri legislature, there are 11 state reps from the St. Louis region. All of them are Democrats. Of the state senators, there are 4 state senators that represent the St. Louis area in Jefferson City. 3 of the 4 of them are Democrats. Does anybody see a pattern here? If you're going to talk about things like the unemployment rate, if you're going to talk about things like the out-of-wedlock birth rate, if you're going to talk about things like graduation rates, I think you have to look at who's been in power since 1945. Who's run the Board of Aldermen? Who's run the city? Who's represented this area in Jefferson City the longest? If you're trying to blame Republican policies, I don't know how that's going to work for you. I will have more on this study and more on this editorial in the Post-Dispatch this coming week at newsninja2012.com. So please go there and check it out and check out all of the rest of my awesome News Ninja buddies, because they are excellent, excellent writers. Every one of them is fantastic at what they do, so please go check it out. I'm going to take off here tonight. We will be on vacation next week, so we will not be here next Friday, but start looking for some different things here at Conservative Cauldron Radio, a new and improved Conservative Cauldron Radio, if you will. You know, we're going to take a look at some things. We're going to add. We're going to subtract. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. You know, we'll see what happens, but it'll all be a great surprise. So please go to conservativecauldron.blogspot.com. Go to Twitter @PatriotWitch. Go to Facebook. newsninja2012.com/BeckyNoble, and please, please, please go to newsninja2012.com and check out War Radio on Live365.com. It is the number one talk radio on Live365.com. I'm Becky Noble. Thanks for hanging out with me tonight, and I will see you next time.
Believe in America, stand up. And if this is the land you love, get up.